You come and go at interesting times, I'll give you that, was how Cord greeted me. We had interrupted her and her co-workers in the middle of some sort of convocation. Everyone was staring at us. One older man in particular. Who's that guy, and why does he hate me? I asked, staring back at him. That would be the boss, Cord said. I noticed that her face was wet. Sure. It didn't occur to me that you'd have one of those. Most people out here do, Raz, she said. When a boss gives you that look, it's considered bad form to stare back the way you are doing.
Is it some kind of social dominance gesture?
Yeah. Also, busting into a private meeting in someone's place of employment is out of bounds.
Well, as long as I have your boss's attention, maybe I should let him know that you called a big meeting here at midday?
Yeah. Or, as he would think of it, you, a total stranger, invited a whole lot of other total strangers to gather on his property, an active industrial site with lots of dangerous equipment, without asking him first.
Well, this is really important, Cord, and it won't last long. Is that why you and your co-workers were having a meeting?
That was the first agenda item.
Do you think he is going to physically assault me? Because I know a little Vlor, not as much as Leo, but
that would be an unusual way to handle it. Out here, it would be a legal dispute.
But you guys have your own separate law, so we can't touch you, and it sounds like the powers that be are leaning on him to let this thing happen. He'll negotiate with them for compensation. He's also negotiating with the insurance company to make sure that none of this voids his policy.
Wow, things are complicated out here.
Cord looked in the direction of the Presidium and sniffled.
And they're not in there?
I thought about that for a while. I guess my disappearance on 10th night probably looks as weird to you as your boss's insurance policy looks to me.
Correct.
Well, it wasn't personal, and it hurt me a lot. Maybe as much as this mess hurts you.
That is unlikely, Cord said. Since 10 seconds before you walked in here, I got fired.
That is wildly irrational behavior, I protested, even by extramural standards.
Yes and no. Yes, it's crazy for me to get fired because of a decision you made without my knowledge, but no, in a way it's not, because I'm weird here. I'm a girl. I use the machines to make jewelry. I make parts for the Eda and get paid in jars of honey.
Well, I'm really sorry. Just stop, she suggested. If there's anything I can do, if you'd like to join
the math you just got thrown out of?
I'm just saying, if there's anything I can do to make it up to you,
give me an adventure.
In the moment that followed, Cord realized that this sounded weird and lost her nerve. She held up her hands.
I'm not talking about some massive adventure, just something that would make getting fired seem small, something that I might remember when I'm old.
Now, for the first time, I reviewed everything that had happened in the last 12 hours.
It made me a little dizzy.
Raz, she said after a while. I can't predict the future, I said. But based on what little I know so far, I'm afraid it has to be a massive adventure or nothing.
Great.
Probably the kind of adventure that ends in a mass burial. That quieted her down a little bit. But after a while, she said,
Do you need transportation? Tools? Stuff?
Our opponent is an alien starship packed with atomic bombs, I said. We have a protractor.
Okay, I'll go home and see if I can scrounge up a ruler and a piece of string.
That'd be great.
See you here at noon.
If they'll let me back in, that is. I'll see to it that they do.
Hey, Cord?
Yeah?
This is probably the wrong time to ask, but could you do me one favor? I went into the shade of the great roof over the canal and sat on a stack of wooden pallets, then took out the cartabla and figured out how to use its interface. This took longer than I'd expected, because it wasn't made for literate people. I couldn't make any headway at all with its search functions, because of all its cack-handed efforts to assist me. Where the heck is Bly's Butte? I asked Archibald when he showed up. It was half an hour before midday. About half of the evoked had arrived. A small fleet of fetches and mobes had begun to form up, Stolen, borrowed, or donated, I had no idea.
I anticipated this, Archibald said.
Bly's relics are all at San Edhar, I reminded him.
Were, he corrected me.
Excellent. What did you steal?
A rendering of the Butte as it appeared 1,300 years ago.
And some of his cosmographical notes? I pleaded.
No such luck.
Archibald's face was all curiosity.
Why would you want Saint Bly's cosmographical notes?
Because he ought to have noted the longitude and latitude of the place from which he was making the observations.
Then I remembered we had no way to determine our longitude and latitude anyway.
But perhaps that information was entombed in the Cartabla's user interface.
Well, perhaps it's all for the best, Archibald sighed.
What?
We are supposed to go directly to Saint Tredegar's. Bly's Butte is not between here and there.
I don't think it's that far out of the way.
Didn't you just tell me you don't know where it is?
I have a rough idea.
You can't even be certain that Orlo went to Bly's Butte. How are you going to persuade 17 of Vought to make an illicit detour to search for a man they anathematized a few months ago?
Archibald, I don't understand you. Why did you bother stealing Bly's relics if you had no intention of going to find Orlo?
At the time I stole them, he pointed out, I didn't know it was a convox.
It took me a moment to follow the logic. You didn't know we'd be coming back.
Correct.
You reckoned after we got finished doing whatever it is they wanted us to do,
we could find Orlo and live as ferals.
That was all interesting. Sort of poignant, too. It did nothing, however, to solve the problem at hand. Archibald, have you noticed any pattern in the lives of the Saints?
Quite a few. Which pattern would you like to draw to my attention?
A lot of them get thrown back before everyone figures out that they are Saints.
Supposing you're right, Archibald said. Orlo's canonization is not going to happen for a long time. He's not a Saint yet.
Beg pardon,
said a man who had lately been hovering nearby with his hands in his pockets.
Are you the leader?
He was looking at me. I naturally glanced around to see what fresh trouble Barb and Jad had gotten into. Barb was standing not far away, watching some birds that had built their nests up in the steel beams that supported the roof. He had been doing this for a solid hour. Jad was squatting in a dusty patch, drawing diagrams using a broken tap as a stylus. Shortly after we'd arrived, Fra Jad had wandered into the machine hall and figured out how to turn on a lathe. Cord's ex-boss almost had attacked me. Since then, both Jad and Barb had been reasonably well-behaved. So why was this extra asking me if I was the leader? He didn't seem angry or scared, more lost. I guessed that by pretending to be the leader, I could make a few things go my way, at least for a little while, until they figured out I was faking it.
Yes, I said. I am called Fra Erasmus.
Oh, good to meet you. Furman Beller,
he said, and extended his hand a little uncertainly. He wasn't sure if we used that greeting. I shook his hand firmly, and he relaxed. He was a stocky man in his fifth decade.
Nice Cartabla you got there.
This seemed like an incredibly strange thing for him to say until I remembered that extras were allowed to have more than three possessions, and that these often served as starting points for small talk. Thanks, I tried. Too bad it doesn't work. He chuckled.
Don't worry, we'll get you there.
I guessed he was one of the locals who had volunteered to drive us.
Say, look, there's a guy over there wants to talk to you. Didn't know if we should, you know, let him approach.
I looked over and saw a man with a black stovepipe on his head, standing in the sun, glaring at me. Please send someone over, I said.
You can't be serious,
Archibald hissed, when Furman was out of range. I sent for him.
How would you go about sending for an Ida?
I asked Cord to do it for me.
Oh, is she here?
He asked in a new tone of voice. I'm expecting her and her boyfriend to show up at any minute, I said, and jumped down off the stack of pallets. Here, figure out where Bly's Butte is. I handed him the Cartabla. The bells of Provenor flipped switches in my brain, as if I were one of those poor dogs that Saints of old would wire up for psychological experiments. First, I felt guilty. Late again. Then my legs and arms ached for the labor of winding the clock. Next would be hunger for the midday meal. Finally, I felt wounded that they had managed to wind the clock without us.
"We're going to hold much of the discussion in Orth because many of us don't really speak Fluckish," I announced from my pallet stack podium to the whole group. 17 of Out, 1 Ida, and a roster of Extramuros people that grew and shrank according to their attention span and Jija usage, but averaged about a dozen.
"Sir Tulia will translate some of what we say, but a lot of our conversation is going to be about stuff that is of interest only to Avout, so you might want to have your own conversation about logistics, such as lunch."
I saw Arcibald nodding. Then I switched to Orth. I was a little slow to get going because I was waiting for someone to point out that I was not actually the leader. But I had called this meeting, and I was standing on the stack of pallets. And I was a tenor.
Our leader would have to be a tenor who would be able to speak Fluckish and deal with the Extramuros world. Not that I was an expert on that, but a hundreder would be even more inept. Fra Jad and the hundreders couldn't very well choose which tenor was going to be the leader because they'd never met any of us until a few hours ago. For years, however, all of them had watched me and my team wind the clock, which gave me, Leo, and Arcibald the advantage that our faces were familiar. Jezri, the natural leader, was gone. I had won Arcibald's loyalty by speaking of lunch. Leo was too goofy and weird. So, through no rational process whatsoever, I was the leader, and I had no idea what I was going to say.
"We have to divide up among several vehicles," I said, stalling for time. "For now, we'll stick with the same mixed groups of tenors and hundreders that were assigned in the narthex this morning. We'll do that because it's simple," I added, because I could see Fra Wybert, a tenor older than me, getting ready to lodge an objection. "Swap things around later if you want, but each tenor is responsible for making sure his hundreders don't end up stranded in a vehicle with non-Orth speakers."
"I think we can all happily accept that responsibility," I said, looking Fra Wybert in the eye. He looked ready to plane me, but decided to back down for reasons I could only guess at.
"How will those groups be distributed among vehicles? My sib, Cord, the young woman in the vest with the tools, has offered to take some of us in her fetch. That's a Fluckish word. It is that industrial-looking vehicle that seems like a box on wheels. She wants me and her liaison partner, Rosk, the big man with the long hair, in there with her. Fra Jad and Fra Barb are with me. I have invited Saman of the Ita to join us. I know some of you will object."
They were already objecting.
"But that's why I'm putting him in the fetch with me."
"It's disrespectful to put an Ida in with a thousander," said Sur Rethlet, another tenor.
"Fra Jad," I said, "I apologize that we are discussing you as if you were not present. It goes without saying that you may choose whichever vehicle you want."
"We are supposed to maintain the discipline during Peregrine,"
Barb helpfully reminded us.
"Hey, you guys are scaring the extras," I joked,
because looking over the heads of my Fras and Sewers, I could see the Extramuros people looking unnerved by our arguing. Tulia translated my last remark. The extras laughed. None of the Avout did. But they did settle down a little.
"Fra Erasmus, if I may," said Arcibald.
I nodded. Arcibald faced Barb, but spoke loudly enough for all to hear.
"We have been given two mutually contradictory instructions. One, the ancient standing order to preserve the discipline during Peregrine. Two, a fresh order to get to San Tredegar by any means necessary. They have not provided us with a sealed train coach or any other such vehicle that might serve as a mobile cloister. It is to be small private vehicles or nothing, and we don't know how to drive. I put it to you that the new order takes precedence over the old and that we must travel in the company of extras. And to travel with an Ida is certainly no worse than that. I say it is better in that the Ida understand the discipline as well as we do."
"Saman's in Cord's fetch with me," I concluded, before Barb could let fly any of the objections that had been filling his quiver during Arcibald's statement.
"Fra Jad's wherever he wants to be.
I'll travel in the way you have suggested, and make a change if it is not satisfactory, said Fra Jad.
This silenced the remainder of the 17 for a moment, simply because it was the first time most of them had heard his voice. That might happen immediately, I told him, because the first destination of Cord's Fetch will be Bly's Butte, where I will try to find Orlo. Now the extras really did have something to worry about, for the avowed became quite loud and angry, and my short tenure as self-appointed leader looked to be at an end. But before they pulled me down and anathematized me, I nodded to Saman, who strode forward. I reached down and grabbed his hand and pulled him up to stand alongside me. The novel sight of a Fra touching an Eta broke the other's concentration for a moment. Then Saman began to speak, which was so arresting that after the first few words he had a silent, almost rapt audience. A couple of centenarian sewers plugged their ears and closed their eyes in silent protest. Three others turned their backs on him.
Fra Spellicon told me to go to the telescope of San Smithra and Mylax and retrieve a photomnemonic tablet that Fra Orlo had placed 3 hours before the Starhenge was closed by the Warden Regulant,
Saman announced in correct but strangely accented Orth.
I obeyed. He did not issue any command as to information security relating to this tablet. So before I gave it to him, I made a copy.
And with that, Saman withdrew a photomnemonic tablet from a bag slung over his shoulder.
It contains a single image that Fra Orlo created but never got to see. I summon the image now, he said, manipulating its controls. Fra Erasmus here saw it a few minutes ago. The rest of you may view it if you wish.
He handed it down to the nearest avowed. Others clustered around, though some still refused even to acknowledge that Saman was present.
We need to be discreet and not show this to the extras, I said, because I don't think they have any idea what we are up against.
We, meaning everyone on Arb. But no one heard me because by then they were all looking at the image on the tablet. What the tablet showed did not force anyone to agree with me, but it was a huge distraction from the argument we'd been having. Those who were inclined to see things my way derived new confidence from it. The rest of them lost their nerve. It took an hour to figure out who was going in which vehicle. I couldn't believe it could be so complicated. People kept changing their minds. Alliances formed, frayed, and dissolved. Inter-alliance coalitions snapped in and out of existence like virtual particles. Cord's big boxy fetch, which had 3 rows of seats, was to be occupied by her, Rosk, me, Barb, Jad, and Saman. Furman Beller had a large mob that was made to travel on uneven surfaces. He would take Leo, Arcibald, and 3 of the Hundreders who had decided to throw in with us. We thought we had pretty efficiently filled the 2 largest vehicles, but at the last minute, another extra, who had been making a lot of calls on his Jija, announced that he and his fetch were joining our caravan. The man's name was Ganeliel Crade, and he was pretty clearly some kind of Deolator from a counter-Bayesian arc, whether Warden of Heaven or not, we didn't know yet. His vehicle was an open-back fetch whose bed was almost completely occupied by a motorized tricycle with fat, knobby tires. Only 3 people could fit into its cab. No one wanted to ride with Ganeliel Crade. I was embarrassed on his behalf, though not so embarrassed that I was willing to climb into his vehicle. At the last minute, some younger associate of his stepped up, tossed a duffel bag into the back, and climbed into the cab with him. So that completed the Bly's Butte contingent. The direct to Tredegar contingent comprised 4 mobs, each with 1 owner-driver and 1 tenor. Tullia, Wybert, Rethlet, and Ostaban. Other seats in these vehicles were taken up by Hundreders who wanted no part of an Orlo expedition or by other extras who had volunteered to come on the journey. With the exception of Cord and Rosk, all of the extras appeared to be part of religious groups, which made all of the avowed more or less uncomfortable. I reckoned that if there had been a military base in this area, the secular power might have ordered some soldiers to dress up as civilians and drive us around. But since there wasn't, they'd hit on the idea of relying on organizations that people were willing to volunteer for on short notice,
which in this time and place meant arcs. When I explained it to people in those terms, it seemed to settle them down a little bit. The tenors sort of understood it. The hunderters found it quite difficult to fathom and kept wanting to know more about the ideologies espoused by their would-be drivers, which in no way shortened the process of getting them into vehicles. Gnelliel Crade was probably in his fourth decade, but you could mistake him for a younger man because he was slender and whiskerless. He announced that he knew the location of Bly's Butte and that he would lead us there and we should follow him. Then he got into his fetch and started the engine. Furman Beller ambled over and grinned at him until he opened his window, then started talking to him. Pretty soon I could tell that they were disagreeing about something, mostly by watching Crade's passenger, who was glaring at Beller. I got that mud-on-the-head sense of embarrassment again. Gnelliel Crade had spoken with such confidence that I'd assumed he'd already gone over this plan with Furman Beller and that the two of them had agreed on it. Now it was obvious that no such thing had ever happened. I'd been prepared to follow Crade wherever he led us. I could now see that this business of being the leader was going to be a pain in the neck, because people would always be trying to get me to do the wrong thing or get rid of me altogether. Some leader, I said, referring to myself. Huh? Asked Leo. Don't let me do stupid things anymore, I ordered Leo, who looked baffled. I started walking towards Crade's fetch. Leo and Arcibald followed at a distance. Crade and Beller were openly arguing now. I really wanted no part of this, but I had been cornered into doing something. The problem, I realized, was that Crade claimed to have knowledge we didn't have as to the location of Bly's Butte. That was my fault. I'd made the error of admitting that I didn't know exactly where it was. Inside the consent, it was fine to admit ignorance, because that was the first step on the road to truth. Out here, it just gave people like Crade an opening to seize power. Excuse me? I called out. Beller and Crade stopped arguing and looked at me. One of my brothers has brought with him ancient documents from the consent that tell us where to go. By combining this knowledge with the skills of our Eta and the topographic maps on the Cartabla, we can find our own way to the place we are going.
I know exactly where your friend went, Crade began.
We don't, I said. But as I mentioned, we can figure it out long before we get there.
Well, just follow me and—
That is a brittle plan. If we lose you in traffic, we will be in a bad way.
If you lose me in traffic, you can call me on my G-jaw.
This hurt because Crade was being more rational than I was, but I couldn't back down at this point. Mr. Crade, you may go on ahead if you like and have the satisfaction of beating us there, but if you look in your rear view and notice that we are no longer visible, it is because we have decided to keep our own counsel as to how we should get there. Crade and his passenger now hated me forever, but at least this was over. This plan, however, necessitated a shake-up that put me and Saman in Furman Beller's vehicle with Arcibald. The three of us would navigate. Leo and a hunderter moved to Cord's fetch to balance the load. They would follow. Gnelliel Crade sprayed us with loose rocks as he gunned his fetch out into the open.
That man behaves so much like the villain in a work of literature, it's almost funny, Arcibald observed.
Yes, said one of the hunderters.
It's as if he'd never heard of foreshadowing.
He probably hasn't, I said. But please remember that our driver is the only extra in this vehicle, and so let's show him the courtesy of speaking fluckish at least part of the time.
Go ahead, said the hunderter, and I'll see if I can parse it.
Fra Cormolathu, as this hunderter was called, was a little bit of a dork, but he had volunteered to go fetch Orlo, so he couldn't be all bad. He was 5 or 10 years older than Orlo, and I speculated that he was a friend of Paflagon. How many roads lead northeast, parallel to the mountains? I asked Beller. I was hoping he'd say only one.
Well, several, he said. Which one do you want to take, boss?
By definition, a butte is freestanding, not part of a range, Arcibald said in Orth.
So,
it rises from the plateau south of the mountains, I announced in Fluckish. We don't need to take a mountain road. Beller put the vehicle into gear and pulled out. I waved goodbye to Tulia. She was watching us go, looking a little shocked. Our departure had been abrupt, but I was afraid that if we waited one more minute, there would be another crisis. Tullia had elected to go direct to Tredegar so that she could try to find Ayla. Perhaps I ought to have done the same, but this was not an easy choice, and I thought I was choosing rightly. If all went well, we'd get to Tredegar only a couple of days later than Tullia's contingent. She'd do a fine job of leading them there. Before leaving town, we stopped, or rather slowed down, at a place where we could get food without spending a lot of time. I remembered this kind of restaurant from my childhood, but it was new to the Hundreders. I couldn't help seeing it as they did. The ambiguous conversation with the unseen serving wench, the bags of hot, grease-scented food hurtling in through the window, condiments in packets, attempting to eat while lurching down a highway, volumes of messy litter that seemed to fill all the empty space in the mob, a smell that outstayed its welcome.
Bayesian Orthodox. The state religion of the Bayesian Empire, which survived the fall of Baz, erected, during the succeeding age, a Mathic system parallel to and independent of that inaugurated by Cartus and endured as one of Arb's largest faiths. Counter-Bayesian. Religion rooted in the same scriptures and honoring the same prophets as Bayesian Orthodoxy, but explicitly rejecting the authority and certain teachings of the Bayesian Orthodox faith. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
By the time we had finished eating, we had passed out of view of the Presidium. We had left most of the Slines Quarter behind us and were moving across a sort of tidal zone that was part of the city when the city was big and part of the country when it wasn't. Where a tidal zone would have driftwood, dead fish, and uprooted seaweed, this had stands of scrawny trees, animals killed by vehicles, and tousled jumpweed. Where the tidal zone would be littered with empty bottles and wrecked boats, this had empty bottles and abandoned fetches. The only thing of consequence was a complex where fuel trees that had been barged down from the mountains were chewed up and processed. There we were caught for a few minutes in a traffic jam of tanker Drummonds. But few of these were going our way, and soon we had got clear of them and passed into the district of vegetable gardens and orchards that stretched beyond. In my vehicle, besides me and Firmin Beller, were Arcibald, Saman, and 200er Fraz, Kermalithu, and Harbert. The other vehicle contained Cord, Rosk, Leo, Barb, Jad, and another Edharian from the Hundreder map, Fra Kriskin. I noted a statistical oddity, which was that there was only one female, and that was my Sib, who was pretty unconventional as females went. Intramuros, we didn't often see the numbers get so skewed. Extramuros, of course, it depended on what religions and social mores prevailed at a given time. Naturally, I wondered how this had come about and spent a little while reviewing my memories of the hour-long scramble to get people into vehicles. Of course, the biggest factor in determining who'd go in which group was how one thought about Orlo and the mission to go and find him. Perhaps there was something about this foray that smelled good to men and bad to women. We numbered 12, not counting Ganeliel Crade. This was a common size for an athletic team or a small military unit. It had been speculated for a long time that this was a natural size for a hunting party of the Stone Age, and that men were predisposed to feel comfortable in a group of about that size. Anyway, whether it was a statistical anomaly or primitive behavior programmed into our sequences, this was what we had ended up with. I spent a few minutes wondering whether Tullia and some of the other sewers in the Straight to Tredegar contingent hated me for letting it come out this way, then forgot about it, since we needed to think about navigation. From the drawing that Arcibald had supplied, which showed the profile of a range of mountains in the distance, and from certain clues in the story of Saint Bly as recorded in the Chronicles, and from things that Saman looked up on a kind of super Gija, we were able to identify three different isolated mountains on the Cartabla, any one of which might have been Bly's Butte. They formed a triangle about 20 miles on a side, a couple of 100 miles from where we were now. It didn't seem that far away, but when we showed it to Firmin, He told us we shouldn't expect to reach it until tomorrow. The roads in that area, he explained, were new gravel, and it would be slow going. We could get there today, but it would be dark and we wouldn't be able to do anything. Better to find a place to stay nearby and get an early start tomorrow. I didn't understand new gravel until several hours later when we turned off the main highway and onto a road that had once been paved. It almost would have been faster to drive directly over the earth than to pick our way over this crazed puzzle of jagged slabs. Archibald was uncomfortable being around Saman, which I could tell because he was extremely polite when addressing him. Complaining of motion sickness, he moved up to the seat next to Furman and talked to him in Fluckish. I sat behind him and tried to catch up on sleep. From time to time, my eyelids would part as we caught air over a gap in the road, and I'd get a dreamy glimpse of some religious fetish swinging from the control panel. I was no expert on arcs, but I was pretty sure that Furman was Bayesian Orthodox. At some level, this was just as crazy as believing in whatever Gonelliel Crade believed, but it was a far more traditional and predictable form of crazy. Still, if a group of religious fanatics had wanted to abduct a few carloads of avowed, they couldn't have done a slicker job of it. That's why I snapped awake when I heard Furman Beller mention God. Until now, he'd avoided it, which I could not understand. If you sincerely believed in God, how could you form one thought, speak one sentence, without mentioning him? Instead of which, deolaters like Beller would go on for hours without bringing God into the conversation at all. Maybe his God was remote from our doings. Or, more likely, maybe the presence of God was so obvious to him that he felt no more need to speak of it than did I to point out all the time that I was breathing air. Frustration was in Beller's voice. Not angry or bitter. This was the gentle, genial frustration of an uncle who can't get something through a nephew's head. We seemed so smart. Why didn't we believe in God?
"We're observing the Sconic discipline," Archibald told him,
happy and a bit relieved to have been given an opportunity to clear this up. He was too optimistic, I thought, too confident he could get Beller to see it our way.
"It's not the same thing as not believing in God. Though," he hastily added, "I can see why it looks that way to one who's never been exposed to Sconic thought."
"I thought your discipline came from Sant Cardus," said Beller.
"Indeed, one can trace a direct line from the Cartesian principles of the old Mathic age to many of our practices, but much has been added and a few things have been taken away."
"So I guess Scon was another Sant who added something?"
"No, a Scon is a little cake."
Beller chuckled in the forced, awkward way that extras did when someone told a joke that was not funny.
"I'm serious," Archibald said. "Sconism is named after the little tea cakes. It is a system of thought that was discovered about halfway between the rebirth and the terrible events, the high water mark of Praxic Age civilization, if you will. A couple of hundred years earlier, the gates of the old maths had been flung open, the avowed had gone forth and mingled with the seculars, mostly seculars of wealth and status, lords and ladies. The globe by this point had been explored and charted. The laws of dynamics had been worked out and were just beginning to come into praxic use."
The mechanic age,
Beller tried, dredging up a word he'd been forced to memorize in some souvenir a long time ago.
"Yes. Clever people could make a living in those days just by hanging around in salons, discussing metatheorics, writing books, tutoring the children of nobles and industrialists. It was the most harmonious relationship between,
us and you?"
Beller suggested.
"Yes. That had existed since the golden age of Ethros. Anyway, there was one great lady named Barito, whose husband was a philandering idiot, but never mind. She took advantage of his absence to run a salon in her house. All the best metatheoricians knew to gather there at a particular time of day when the scones were coming out of her ovens. People came and went over the years, so Lady Barito was the only constant. She wrote books, but, as she herself is careful to say, the ideas in them can't be attributed to any one person. Someone dubbed it Sconic thought, and the name stuck."
"And it all got incorporated into your discipline, what, a couple of hundred years later?"
"Yes, not in a very formal way, though. More as a set of habits, thinking habits, that many of the new avowed already shared when they came in the gates.
Such as not believing in God,
Beller asked.
And here, though we were driving on fair level ground, I felt as I would have if we'd been on a mountain track with a 1,000-foot cliff to one side, which Beller could have spilled us into with a twitch of the controls. Arcibald was relaxed, though, which I marveled at because he could be so high-strung about matters that were so much less dangerous.
Studying this is sort of a pie-eating contest, Arcibald began.
This was a fluckish expression that Leo, Jezri, Arcibald, and I used to mean a long, thankless trudge through a pile of books. It completely wrong-footed Beller, who thought we were talking of scones, and so here Arcibald had to spend a minute or two disentangling these two baked goods references.
I'll try to sketch it out, Arcibald continued, once they'd gotten back on track. Sconic thought was a third way between two unacceptable alternatives. By then it was well understood that we'd do all of our thinking up here in our brains, he tapped his head, and that the brain gets its inputs from eyes, ears, and other sense organs. The naive attitude is that your brain works directly with the real world. I look at this button on your control panel. I reach out and feel it with my hand.
Don't touch that, Beller warned.
I see you seeing it and having thoughts about it, and I conclude that it's really there, just as my eyes and fingers present it to me, and that when I think about it, I'm thinking about the real thing.
That all seems pretty obvious, Beller said.
Then there was an awkward silence, which Beller finally broke by saying, in good humor,
I guess that's why you called it naive.
At the opposite extreme, there were those who argued that everything we think we know about the world outside of our skulls is an illusion.
Seems kind of smart-alecky more than anything else,
Beller said after considering it for a bit.
The Sconics didn't much care for it either. As I said, they developed a third attitude. When we think about the world, or about almost anything, they said, what we are really thinking about is a bunch of data, givens, that have reached our brains from our eyes and ears and so forth. To go back to my example, I am given a visual image of that button, and I am given a memory of what it felt like when I touched it, but that's all I have to work with, as far as that button is concerned. It is impossible, unthinkable, for my brain to come to grips with the actual physical button in and of itself because my brain simply does not have access to it. All that my brain can ever work with are the look and the feel, givens piped into our nerves.
Well, I guess I see the point. It doesn't have that smart-aleckiness of the other one you mentioned, but it seems like a distinction without a difference,
Beller said. It's not, Arcibald said. And here is where the pie-eating contest would begin, if you wanted to understand why it's not. Because, starting from this idea, the Sconics went on to develop a whole metatheorical system. It was so influential that no one has been able to do metatheorics since then without coming to grips with it. All subsequent metatheorics is a refutation, an amendment, or an extension of Sconic thought. And one of the most important conclusions you arrive at if you make it to the end of the pie-eating contest is that
there is no God.
No, something different and harder to sum up. Which is that certain topics are simply out of bounds. The existence of God is one of those.
What do you mean, out of bounds?
If you follow through the logical arguments of the Sconic system, you are led to the conclusion that our minds can't think in a productive or useful way about God. If by God you mean the Bayesian Orthodox God, which is clearly not spatial-temporal, not existing in space and time, that is.
But God exists everywhere and in all times.
Beller said. But what does it really mean to say that? Your God is more than this road and that mountain and all the other physical objects in the universe put together, isn't he?
Sure, of course. Otherwise, we'd just be nature worshippers or something.
So it's crucial to your definition of God that he is more than just a big pile of stuff.
Of course.
Well, that more is by definition outside of space or time. And the Sconics demonstrated that we simply cannot think in a useful way about anything that in principle can't be experienced through our senses.
And I can already see from the look on your face that you don't agree.
I don't, Beller affirmed. But that's beside the point. The point is that after the Skonics, the kinds of people who did theorics and metatheorics stopped talking about God and certain other topics such as free will and what existed before the universe. And that is what I mean by the Skonic discipline. By the time of the Reconstitution, it had become ingrained. It was incorporated into our discipline without much discussion or even conscious awareness.
Well, but with all the free time you've got sitting there in your conscience, couldn't someone be troubled in 4,000 years to be aware of it, to discuss it?
We have less free time than you imagine, Arcibald said gently. But nevertheless, many people have devoted much thought to the matter and founded orders devoted to denying God or believing in him, and currents have surged back and forth in and among the maths. But none of it seems to have moved us away from the basic position of the Skonics.
Do you believe in God?
Beller asked, flat out.
I leaned forward, fascinated.
I have been reading a lot lately about things that are non-spatial temporal, yet believed to exist.
By this I knew he meant mathematical objects in the Hylian theoric world.
Doesn't that go against the Skonic discipline?
Beller asked. Yes, Arcibald said, but that is perfectly all right, as long as one isn't going about it in a naive way, as if Lady Barito had never written a word. A common complaint made about the Skonics is that they didn't know much about pure theorics. Many theoricians, looking at Barito's works, say, wait just a minute, there's something missing here. We can relate directly to non-spatial temporal objects when we prove theorems and so on. The stuff I've been reading lately is all about that.
So you can see God by doing theorics?
Not God, Arcibald said. Not a God that any arc would recognize. After that, he managed to change the subject. He, like I, had been wondering what the powers that be might have told Furman and the others when they had put out the call for volunteers. The answer seemed to be, not much. The secular power needed some sort of puzzle solved, the sort of thing that Avout were good at. Some Fras and Sewers would have to be moved from point A to point B so that they could work on this conundrum. People like Furman Beller were naturally curious about us. They had all learned about the Reconstitution in their Suvans, and they understood that we had an assigned role to play, however sporadically, in making their civilization work. They were fascinated to see the mechanism being invoked at least once in their lives and were proud to be a part of it, even if they hadn't a clue as to why it was being engaged. In the hottest part of the afternoon, we pulled off into the shade of a line of trees that had once served as windbreak for a farm compound, now collapsed. We hadn't seen Crade in hours, but Cord's fetch was right behind us. Some of us walked around and some dozed. The mountains darkened the northwestern sky, though if you didn't know what they were, you might mistake them for a storm front. On their opposite slope, they caught most of the moisture blowing in from the ocean and funneled it into the river that ran through our consent. Consequently, this side was arid. Only bunch grass and low fragrant shrubs would grow here of their own accord. From age to age, the secular power would irrigate it and people would live here growing grain and legumes, but we were now on the wane of such a cycle, as was obvious from the condition of the roads, the farmsteads, and what were shown on the cartabla as towns. The old irrigation ditches were fouled by whatever would grow in them, which was mostly things with thorns, spines, and detachable burrs. Leo and I went for a brisk walk along one of these, but we didn't say much as we were keeping an eye out for snakes. Saman kept looking as if he had something to say. We decided on a shake-up that put me and him in Cord's fetch, while Leo and Barb went to Furman's mob. Barb wanted to stay with Jad, but we all knew that Jad must be getting a little weary of his company, and so we insisted. Cord was tired of driving, so Rosk took the controls.
Furman Beller is communicating with a Bayesian installation on one of those mountains, Saman told me.
This was an odd phrasing, since Baz had been sacked 5,200 years ago.
As in Bayesian Orthodox? I asked.
Saman rolled his eyes.
Yes.
A religious institution?
Or something.
How do you know this?
Never mind. I just thought you might want to know that Ganeliel Crade isn't the only one with an agenda.
I considered asking Saman what his agenda was, but decided to let it drop. He was probably wondering how a bunch of Bayesian priests would treat an Eta.
My agenda was looking at the photomnemonic tablet, which I knew that everyone in this vehicle, except for Cord, who'd been driving, must have been studying. I'd only had a brief look at it before. Cord and I sat together in the back. The sun was shining in, so we threw a blanket over our heads and huddled in the dark like a couple of kids playing campout. This thing that Orlo had wanted so badly to take pictures of, would it be something that we would recognize as a ship? Until Saman had showed me this tablet a few hours ago, all I had known was that it used bursts of plasma to change its velocity, and that it could shine red lasers on things. For all I'd known, it could have been a hollowed-out asteroid. It could have been an alien life form adapted to live in the vacuum of space that shot bombs out of a sphincter. It could have been constructed out of things that we would not even recognize as matter. It could have been only half in this universe and half in some other. So I made an effort to open my mind. I had been prepared to be confronted by some sort of image that I would not be able to understand at first. And it had indeed been a riddle, but not the kind of riddle I'd been expecting. I hadn't had time to study it, to puzzle over it at the time. Now I had a good long look. The image was streaked in the direction of the ship's motion. Fra Orlo had probably set up the telescope to track it across the sky, but he'd had to make his best guess as to its direction and speed, and he hadn't gotten it exactly right, hence the motion blur. I guessed that this was only the last in a series of such images that Orlo had been making during the weeks leading up to Appert, each slightly better than the last as he learned how to track the target and how to calibrate the exposure. Saman had already applied some kind of syntactic process to the image to reduce the blur and bring out many details that would have been lost otherwise. It was an icosahedron. 20 faces, each of them an equilateral triangle. That much I'd seen when Saman had first shown it to me. And therein lay the puzzle, because such a shape could be either natural or artificial. Geometers loved icosahedrons, but so did nature. Viruses, spores, and pollens had all been known to take this shape. So perhaps it was a space-adapted life form, or a giant crystal that had grown in a gas cloud. This thing can't be pressurized, I pointed out, because the surfaces are all flat, Cord said, more as statement than question. She dealt with compressed gases in our work and knew in her bones that any vessel containing pressure must be rounded, a cylinder, a sphere, or a torus.
Keep looking,
Saman advised us. The corners, Cord said. Vertices, I said. Those 20 triangular facets came together at 12 vertices. Each vertex joined 5 triangles. These seemed to bulge outward a little. At first, I'd mistaken this for blur, but on a closer look, I convinced myself that each vertex was a little sphere. And this drew my eye to the edges. The 12 vertices were joined by a network of 30 straight edges. And those, too, had a rounded, bulging look to them. There they are, said Cord. I knew exactly what she meant. The shock absorbers, I said. For it was obvious now. Each of the 30 edges was a long, slender shock absorber, just like the ones on the suspension of Cord's fetch, except bigger. The frame of this ship was just a network of 30 shock absorbers that came together at a dozen spherical vertices. The entire thing was one big distributed shock absorption system. There must be ball and socket joints in the corners to make that work, Cord said. Yeah, otherwise the frame couldn't flex, I said. But there's a big part of this I'm not getting. What are the flats made of? The triangles? Cord said. Yeah. No point making a triangle out of things that can give unless the stuff in the middle can give too, change its shape a little when the shocks flex. So we spent a while puzzling over the 20 flat triangular surfaces that accounted for the ship's surface area. These, I thought, looked a little funny. They looked rugged. Not smooth metal, but cobbled together. I could almost swear it's stucco. I was going to say concrete, Cord said.
Think gravel, suggested Saman.
Okay, Cord said. Gravel has some give to it where concrete doesn't, but how's it held together? There are a lot of little rocks floating around up there, I said. In a way, gravel's the most plentiful solid thing you can obtain in space.
Yeah, but that doesn't answer your question, I admitted.
Who knows? Maybe they have woven some kind of mesh to hold them in place.
Erosion control, Cord said, nodding.
What?
You see it on the banks of rivers when they're trying to stop erosion. They'll throw a bunch of rocks into a cube of wire mesh, then stack the cubes and wire them together.
It's a good analogy, I said. You need erosion control in space, too.
How do you figure?
Micrometeoroids and cosmic rays are always coming in from all directions. If you can surround your ship with a shell of cheap material, aka gravel, you've cut down quite a bit on the problem.
Hey, wait a sec, she said. This one looks different.
She was pointing to one face that had a circle inscribed in it. We hadn't noticed it at first because it was around to one side, foreshortened, harder to make out. The circle was clearly made of different stuff. I had the feeling it was hard, smooth, and stiff.
Not only that, I pointed out, but she'd caught it too. No shocks around this one.
The three edges outlining this face were sharp and simple.
I've got it, I said. That one is the pusher plate. The what?
I explained about the atomic bombs and the pusher plate. She accepted this much more readily than any of us had. The ship that Leo had shown us in the book had been a stack. Pusher plate, shocks, crew quarters. This one was an envelope. The outer shell was one large distributed shock absorber, as well as a shield. And I was beginning to realize, a shroud. A veil to hide whatever was suspended in the middle. Once we'd identified the pusher plate, the stern of the ship, our eyes were naturally drawn to the face on the opposite or forward end, its prow. This was hidden from view, but one of the adjoining shock absorbers was visible, and something was written on it. Printed there neatly was a line of glyphs that had to be an inscription in some language. Some of the glyphs, like circles and simple combinations of strokes, could easily be mistaken for characters in our Bayesian alphabet, but others belonged to no alphabet that I had ever seen. And yet they were so close to our letters that this alphabet seemed almost like a sib of ours. Some of them were Bayesian letters turned upside down or reflected in a mirror. I flung the blanket off.
Hey,
Cord complained, and closed her eyes. Fra Jad turned around and looked me in the face. He seemed ever so slightly amused.
These people, I did not call them aliens, are related to us.
We have started referring to them as the cousins, announced Fra Kriskin, the hundreder sitting next to Fra Jad.
What could possibly explain that?
I demanded, as if they could possibly know such a thing.
These others have been speculating about it, Fra Jad said, wasting their time, as it is just a hypothesis.
How big is this thing? Has anyone tried to estimate its dimensions? I asked.
I know that from the settings of the telescope and the tablet, Saman said, it is about 3 miles in diameter.
Let me spare you having to work it out in your head, said Fra Kriskin, watching my face, mildly amused. If you want to generate pseudo-gravity by spinning part of the ship...
Like those old donut-shaped space stations and spec-fix feelies? I asked.
Kriskin looked blank.
I've never seen a spiely, but yes, I think we are talking about the same thing.
Sorry.
It's okay. If you are playing that game and you want to generate the same level of gravity we have here on Arb, and if there is such a thing hidden inside of this icosahedron...
Which is kind of what I was imagining, I allowed.
Say it's 2 miles across. The radius is 1 mile. It would have to spin about once every 80 seconds to provide Arb gravity.
Seems reasonable. Doable, I said.
What are you talking about? Cord asked.
Could you live on a merry-go-round that spun once every minute and a half?
She shrugged.
Sure.
Are you talking about where the cousins came from?
Shouted Rosk over his shoulder. He couldn't understand Orth, but he could pick out some words, and he could read our tones of voice.
We're debating whether it is productive to have any such discussion at all, I said.
But that was a little too complicated, shouted from the back of the fetch over road noise.
In Bucks and Spielies, sometimes you see a fictional universe where an ancient race seeded a bunch of different star systems with colonies that lost touch with each other afterwards,
Rosk volunteered. The other avowed in the vehicle looked as if they were biting their tongues.
The problem is, Rosk, we have a fossil record
that goes back billions of years. Yeah, that is a problem with that idea,
Rosk admitted, from which I guessed that others had already torn this idea limb from limb before his eyes, but Rosk liked it too much to let go of it. He'd never been taught Dyax's rake. Cord had put the blanket back over her head, but she said,
Another idea that we were talking about earlier was, you know, the whole concept of parallel universes. Then Fra Jad pointed out that this ship is quite clearly in this universe.
Ah, what a killjoy, I remarked. In Fluckish, obviously.
Yeah,
she said.
It is a real drag hanging around with you people. So logical. Speaking of which, did you notice the geometry proof?
What?
They couldn't stop talking about it earlier.
I ducked back under the blanket with her. She knew how to pan and zoom the image. She magnified one of the faces, then dragged it around until the screen was filled with something that looked like streaked and blurry overlapping geometrical outlines.
That's certainly a weird thing to put on your ship, I said.
I zoomed back out for a moment because I wanted to get a sense of where this diagram was located. It was centered on one of the icosahedron's faces, adjoining and just aft of the one that we had identified as the bow. If the ship's envelope was made of gravel, held in some kind of matrix, then this diagram had been built into this face as a sort of mosaic, by picking out darker pieces of gravel and setting them carefully into place. They had put a lot of work into it.
It's their emblem, I said.
Only speculating, but no one spoke out against the idea. I zoomed back in and spent a while examining the network of lines. It was obviously a proof, almost certainly of the Adraconic theorem. The sort of problem that FIDS worked all the time as an exercise. Just as if I were sitting in a chalk hall trying to get the answer quicker than Jezri, I began to break it down into triangles and to look for right angles and other features that I could use to anchor a proof. Any FID from the halls of Orathena probably would have gotten it by now, but my plain geometry was a little rusty. Wait a minute, some part of my mind was saying. I poked my head out from under the blanket, careful this time not to blind Cord.
This is just plain creepy, I said.
That's the same word Leo used,
Rosk shouted back.
Why do you guys all think it's creepy? Cord wanted to know.
Please supply a definition of the oft-used Fluckish word creepy, said Fra Jad.
I tried to explain it to the Thousander, but primitive emotional states were not what Orth was good at.
An intuition of the numinous, Fra Jad hazarded, combined with a sense of dread.
Dread is a strong word, but you are close. Now I had to answer Cord's question. I made a few false starts. Then I saw Saman watching me, and I got an idea. Saman here is an expert on information. Communication, to him, means transmitting a series of characters.
Like the letters on this shock absorber,
Cord asked.
Exactly, I said. But since the cousins use different letters and have a different language, a message from them would look to us like something written in a secret code. We'd have to decipher it and translate it into our language, instead of which the cousins have decided here to
bypass language,
Saman said, impatient with my floundering.
Exactly. And instead, they have gone directly to this picture.
You think they put it there for us to see? Cord asked.
Why else would you go to the trouble to put something on the outside of your ship? They wanted to mark themselves with something they knew we'd understand, and that is what's creepy. The fact that they just knew in advance that we'd understand this.
I don't understand it, Cord protested.
Yet. But you know what it is, and we could get you to understand it a lot faster than we could decipher an alien language.
It looks to me as though Fra Jad has already worked it out. My eye had fallen on a leaf in his lap that bore a copy of the diagram, with some marks and notations that he had added as he had worked through the logic of the proof.
Logic. Proof. The cousins had these, had them in common with us. with us who lived in consents, that is. A vout with nukes. Roaming from star system to star system in a bomb-powered consent, making contact with their planet-bound brethren. Oh, snap out of it, Raz, I said to myself.
Yes, said Fra Jad,
who'd been watching my face.
Please do.
They came, I said. The cousins did, and the secular power picked them up on radar, tracked them, worried about them, took pictures of them, saw that. I pointed to the proof on Fra Jad's lap. Recognized it as an avout thing, got worried, figured out that the ship had been detected somehow by at least one Fra, Orlo.
I told him about it, Saman said.
What? Saman looked uncomfortable. But I'd gotten it all so badly wrong that he couldn't contain himself. He had to straighten me out.
A communication reached us from the secular power, he said.
Us meaning the Eda?
A third order reticule.
Huh?
Never mind. We were told to go in secret, bypassing the hierarchs, to the consent's foremost cosmographer and tell him of this thing.
And then what?
There were no further instructions, Saman said.
So you chose Orlo?
Saman shrugged. I went to his vineyard one night while he was alone, cursing at his grapes, and told him this. Told him I had stumbled across it while reviewing logs of routine mail protocol traffic.
I didn't understand a word of his Eda gibberish, but I got the gist of it. So, part of your orders from the secular power were to make it seem that this was just you, acting on your own.
So that they could later deny that they had anything to do with it, Saman said, when it came time to crack down.
I doubt that they were so premeditated, Fra Jad put in, using a mild tone of voice, as Saman and I had become heated, conspiratorial. Let us get out the rake, Jad went on. The secular power had radar, but not pictures. To get pictures, they needed telescopes and people who knew how to use them. They did not want to involve the hierarchs. So they devised the strategy that Saman has just explained to us. It was only a means of getting some pictures of the thing as quickly and quietly as possible. But when they did get the pictures, they saw this.
He rested the palm of his hand on the proof in his lap. And then they realized that they'd made a big mistake, I said, in a much calmer tone than before. They had divulged the existence and nature of the cousins to the last people in the world they'd want to know about them.
Hence the closure of the Starhenge and what happened to Orlo, Saman said. And hence me in this fetch, as I have no idea what they'll want to do to me.
I found it strange to hear an Eda voicing such a fear, since usually it was we who worried about their sneaky tricks, such as the one that had ensnared Orlo. Then my point of view snapped around and I saw it his way. Precisely because people believed the things they did about the Eda, no one was likely to believe Saman's story or stand up for him if all of these doings broke out into the open. So you made this copy of the tablet and kept it so that you would have
something, he said, that I could leverage.
And you showed yourself in Klesthra's eye, announcing in a deniable way that you knew something, that you had information.
Advertising, Saman said,
and the shape of his face changed, whiskers shifting on whiskers, his way of hinting at a smile. Well, it worked, I said. And here you are on the road to nowhere being driven around by a bunch of deolaters. Cord got fed up with hearing Orth and moved up to the front of the fetch to sit with Rosk. I felt sorry, but some things were nearly impossible to talk about in Fluckish. I was dying to ask Fra Jad about the nuclear waste, but was reluctant to broach this topic with Saman listening. So I drew my own copy of the proof on the cousin's ship and began working on it. Before long, I got bogged down. Cord and Rosk started playing some music on the fetch's sound system, softly at first, more loudly when no one objected. This had to be the first time Fra Jad had ever heard popular music. I cringed so hard I thought I'd get internal injuries, but the Thousander accepted it as calmly as he had the Dynaglibe Lubristrip. I gave up trying to work the proof and just looked out the window and listened to the music. In spite of all my prejudices against Extramuros culture, I kept being surprised by moments of beauty in these songs.
Most of them were forgettable, but 1 in 10 sheltered some turn or inflection that proved that the person who had made it had achieved some kind of upsight, had, for a moment, got it. I wondered if this was a representative sampling, or if Cord was just unusually good at finding songs with beauty in them and loading only those onto her G-jaw. The music, the heat of the afternoon, the jouncing of the fetch, my lack of sleep, and shock at leaving the consent, with all of these affecting me at once, it was no wonder I couldn't work a proof. But as the day grew old and the sun came in more and more horizontally, as the dying towns and ruined irrigation systems came less and less frequently, and the landscape was purified into high desert, spattered with stony ruins, I started thinking that something else was working on me. I was used to Orlo being dead, not literally dead and buried, of course, but dead to me. That is what Anathem did, killed an avowed without damaging the body. Now, with only a few hours to get used to the idea, I was about to see Orlo again. At any moment, for all I knew, we might spy him hiking up one of these lonely crags to get ready for a night's observations. Or perhaps his emaciated corpse was waiting for us under a cairn, thrown up by slimes descended from those who had eaten Saint Bly's liver. Either way, it was impossible for me to think of anything else when I might be confronted by such a thing at any moment. Cord's face was shining on me. She reached for a control and turned down the music, then repeated something. I had gone into a sort of trance, which I shattered by moving. "Furmon's on the G-jaw," she explained. "He wants to stop. Pee and parley."
Both sounded good to me.
We pulled off at a wide place in the road along a curving grade, a third of the way into a descent that would, over the next half hour, take us into a flat-bottomed valley that connected to the horizon. This was no valley of the wet and verdant type, but a failure in the land where withered creeks went to die and flash floods spent their rage on a supine waste. Spires and palisades of brown basalt hurled shadows much longer than they were tall. Two solitary mountains rose up perhaps 20 or 30 miles away. We gathered around the cartabla and convinced ourselves that those were two of the three candidates we had chosen earlier. As for the third, well, it appeared that we had just driven around it and were now scouring its lower slopes. Furmon wanted to talk to me in my capacity as leader. I shook off the last wisps of the near coma I had sunk into and drew myself up straight.
"I know you guys don't believe in God," he began, "but considering the way you live, well, I thought you might feel more at home staying with..."
"Bayesian monks?" I hazarded.
"Yes, exactly."
He was a little taken aback that I knew this. It was only a lucky guess. When Saman had mentioned earlier that Furmon was talking to a Bayesian installation, I had imagined a cathedral, or at any rate something opulent. That was before I'd seen the landscape. "A monastery," I said, "is on one of those mountains?"
"The closer of the two. You can see it about halfway up, on the northern flank."
With some hints from Furmon, I was able to see a break in the mountain slope, a sort of natural terrace sheltered under a crescent of dark green. Trees, I assumed.
"I've been there for retreats," Furmon remarked. "Used to send my kids there every summer."
The concept of a retreat didn't make sense to me until I realized that it was how I lived my entire life. Furmon misinterpreted my silence. He turned to face me and held up his hands, palms out.
"Now, if you're not comfortable, let me tell you we have enough water and food and bedrolls and so on that we can camp anywhere we like. But I was thinking..."
"It's reasonable," I said. "If they'll accept women."
"The monks have their own cloister, separate from the camp. But girls stay at the camp all the time. They have women on the staff."
It had been a long day. The sun was going down. I was tired. I shrugged.
"If nothing else," I said, "it might make for a good story or two for us to tell when we get to Saint Tredegar."
Leo and Archibald had been hovering. They pounced on me as soon as Furmon Beller started to walk away. They both had the somewhat tense and frayed look of people who had just spent several hours cooped up with Barb.
"Fra Erasmus," Archibald began, "let's be realistic. Look at this landscape. There's no way anyone could live here on his own. How would one obtain food, water, medical care?"
trees are growing on one place on that mountain, I said. That probably means that there is fresh water. People like Furman send their kids here for summer camp. How bad can it be?
It's an oasis,
Leo said, having fun whipping out this exotic word. Yeah, and if the nearer butte has an oasis large enough for a monastery and a summer camp, why couldn't the farther one have a place where pharaohs like Bly, Estimard, and Orlo could live in the shade and drink spring water?
That doesn't solve the problem of getting food, Arcibald pointed out.
Well, it's an improvement on the picture that I've been carrying around in my head, I said. I didn't have to explain this to the others because they'd had it in their heads, too. Desperate men living on the top of a mountain, eating lichens. There must be a way, I continued. The Bayesian monks do it.
They are a larger community, and they are supported by alms, Arcibald said.
Orlo told me that Estimard had been sending him letters from Bly's Butte for years. And Saint Bly managed to live there for a while.
Only because slines worshipped him,
Leo pointed out. Well, maybe we'll find a bunch of slines bowing down to Orlo then. I don't know how it works. Maybe there's a tourist industry.
Are you joking?
Arcibald asked. Look at this wide spot in the road where we're stopped, I said.
What of it?
Why do you suppose it's here?
I haven't the faintest idea. I'm not a praxic, Arcibald said. So that vehicles can pass each other more easily?
Leo guessed. I held up my arm, drawing their attention to the view. It's here because of that.
What? Because it's beautiful?
Yeah. And then I turned away from Arcibald and looked at Leo, who started to walk away. I fell in alongside him. Arcibald stayed behind to examine the view as if he could discover some flaw in my logic by staring at it long enough.
Did you get a chance to look at the icosahedron?
Leo asked me. Yeah, and I saw the proof, the geometry.
You think these people are like us, that they will be sympathetic to our point of view as followers of our mother Hylaea,
he said, trying these phrases on me for size. I was already defensive, sensing a flank maneuver. Well, I think that they are clearly trying to get at something by making the Adraconic theorem into their emblem.
The ship is heavily armed,
he said. Obviously. He was already shaking his head.
I'm not talking about the propulsion charges. They'd be almost useless as weapons. I'm talking about other things on that ship, things that become obvious when you look for them.
I didn't see anything that looked remotely like a weapon.
You can hide a lot of equipment on a mile-long shock absorber,
he pointed out.
And who knows what's concealed under all that gravel?
Can you give me an example?
The faces have regularly spaced features on them. I think that they are antennas.
So, obviously, they're going to have antennas.
They are phased arrays,
he said.
Military stuff. Just what you'd want to aim an X-ray laser or a high-velocity impactor. I'll need to consult books to know more. Also, I don't like the planets lined up on the nose.
What do you mean?
There's a row of four disks painted on a forward shock. I think that they are depictions of planets, like on a military aircraft of the Praxic Age.
It took me a few moments to sort out the reference. Wait a minute. You think that they are kills? Leo shrugged. Well, now hold on a second, I said. Couldn't it be that it's something more benign? Maybe those are the home planets of the cousins.
I just think that everyone is too eager to look for a happy, comforting interpretations.
And your role as a warden fendant in the making is to be way more vigilant than that, I said. And you're doing a great job.
Thanks.